Several years ago, when my youngest son graduated from high school, I had bribed him, if you will, that if he got good grades in high school and got into college, that I would buy him a used car. So when he got out of high school, I bought him a BMW. It was an older BMW that we purchased from a good friend who had bought it new and driven it for a while. It was a small 318, if you know anything about the BMW car family. It was a little four-door, four-cylinder sedan. He actually ended up driving it for several years. And during the process, he would talk to me about BMWs, and he became a BMW fan, an aficionado, if you will. He drove that little car almost 10 years, and then he sold it. You know, you hate selling cars to friends, but he sold it to another friend, another pastor, whose daughter was going to college and had a similar bribe going on, I guess. He said, you get into college and I'll get you a car. So he bought my son's discarded 318 for his daughter, and it ran for another 10 years. And the last thing I heard is the BMW is still somewhere in the church family being passed on to other people. So it's had a long life, a few repairs along the way. But anyway, that caused my son to become a BMW fan. When he decided to buy another car, he started shopping for another BMW. He called me one day and said he had found the car that he wanted. A good used M3. A performance BMW sports coupe. Again, if you know anything about BMWs, you know an M3 is a little specially appointed. It's a performance car. It's a two-door car. It's got special dressing around it. It's got a six-cylinder, a straight six, six-speed transmission. It's a fast little performance car. Now, he can afford it. He's an engineer. And he feeds the habit of his BMWs. He bought this little M3 when he told me that he'd bought it off of eBay from a doctor in Indiana. I just about fell off my chair. I've always test driven every car that I've ever bought. I'm a kick the tires sort of guy. Anybody in here, you'd like to see it before you buy it, kick the tires, especially if you're spending tens of thousands of dollars for a car. And I was shocked that my son would buy this car off of eBay. And I said, are you sure, son? He said, yeah, Dad. I said, what'd you do? You didn't pay for it already? Oh, yeah, I sent the doctor a check. Ah! He sent the doctor a check. He didn't have the car. He just looked at it online. I found out later that he had an engineer friend in Indiana who looked at the car. And his friend said, if you don't buy it, I will, which was good motivation. So he bought this car. But I am one of those guys that I like to test it first, especially if you're spending lots of money. It's kind of like buying this house, you know, my daughter and son-in-law. We're helping them with the down payment, and even though we're not signing on the mortgage, I wanted to go there and see it, and I wanted to go kick the walls. I wanted to look in the closet. I wanted to check the floor out. I wanted to see what this was like, you know. But some people these days buy incredible things on eBay and Craigslist sight unseen without testing it. And I kept thinking, that's just not right. And I kept teasing my son, you know, what are you going to buy on eBay next? You know, a house? Why would you want to test something first? Let's turn over to Psalms chapter 26, verses 1 through 3. This psalm actually came into my mind when my son told me about his car buying experience. I might add as a sidelight, as we're turning over to Psalms 26, that he still owns that car. After 10 years, he's put a new engine in it. But he loves that little performance car. He's put new struts in it, new tires, of course, several times over. And the problem is he now has a wife and two children, and it's a little two-door coupe. so he can't even get the child's seat in the back seat. So he says that's his work commuter, and they have another car that they use as their family car. But it amazes me that he won't let go of that M3. He's hanging on to it pretty tight. We read the Psalms of David here, this psalm, Psalm 26. In fact, in my Bible, it says a Psalm of David. And beginning to read in verse 1, Psalms 26, verse 1, "Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity. I have also trusted in the Lord. I shall not slip." Verse 2, Psalms 26, "Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my mind and my heart." I'm reading from the New King James. In the King James, it says, "Try my reins." But what it means is, "Try my mind and my heart, for your loving kindness is before my eyes, and I have walked in your truth." I don't know about you, but I don't often in my prayers ask God to try me. I don't know, it seems like you're inviting trouble, if you know what I mean, right? But David wasn't saying, "Send me a trial." He was saying, "Test me. Kick the tires. Take a look around. Look inside me." And that's what I look for, you know, when I drive a car that I'm thinking about buying. I say, "Can I drive it? Can I test drive it?" And I get in the front seat and I feel the car. Does it feel comfortable? And I drive it. I listen to the engine, you know. What's it sound like? I listen for the gears to change in the transmission. What's that sound like? You know, you want to test the heart of the vehicle. And David is basically saying the same thing about himself. "Examine me, O Lord, and prove me." I find that Barnes Study Bible is very helpful with many of these scriptures. This one particularly was helpful. Let me share with you what Barnes Notes says about Psalms 26, verse 2. He says there are basically three tests that are requested here by David. Three tests. "Examine me, O Lord," is test number one. The meaning of this verse is that he asked of God a strict and rigid examination of his case. To express this, the psalmist uses three words: examine, prove, try. These words are designed to include the modes in which the reality of anything is tested, and they imply together that he wished the most thorough investigation to be made. He did not shrink from any test. He evidently felt that it was essential to his welfare that the most rigid examination should be made. But the exact truth should be known, that if he was deceived, it was best for himself that he should not be left under the delusion, but that understanding his own case, he might be led to secure his salvation. The word rendered "exam" means to try or to prove, and is applicable especially to metals, which I think is interesting in the Hebrew. It means here to apply to me such tests as are applied to metals in order to determine their genuineness and their value. For example, in this part of the country, we have a lot of people who have the hobby, some the profession of panning for gold in the rivers around here, right? And when you get, you know, some gold dust or maybe even some nuggets, you would naturally want to test them by taking them to an assayer who will melt those down and get all the impurities out of it and find out how much pure gold you've actually discovered in the bed of the river, right? I think we all understand that. Probably many of you here pan for gold. And my grandson is coming to visit at some point before summer camp, and I plan to take him up to Placerville or someplace up here where you can actually pan for a little gold and run him through the experience. I don't expect to find much, but I want him to know what this part of the country is all about. Continuing on, to prove me, second test David asked about. Barnes note says, a word of similar import. In the original meaning of the word, there is a reference to smell, to try by smell. I'll give you an example. My wife and I enjoy sushi. We really like sushi. And we like, particularly, we like tuna. And when we go into a store, and many times we've done this, we want to buy sushi-grade tuna. And the best way to determine whether or not the tuna is really good is to ask the butcher, whoever's behind the counter, can I smell it? And he'll put a piece on a piece of paper, and he'll hand it to you, and you give it the smell test. Now, sushi-grade tuna, really good tuna, doesn't smell like anything. There's no smell at all. So when you sniff it and you smell fish, it ain't very good. It's already started to go, as they say, the other way. It's already started to turn. And if you've ever been to a sushi restaurant and you taste salmon has a little bit of a taste, but salmon or ahi or tuna should not have any taste. That's why you wrap it in things that have taste and you dip it into sauces that have taste. You add the taste to the texture of the meat. Now, many of you here, I can tell by the look on your face, probably think that raw tuna and salmon should only be used as bait, which I understand. I had that feeling for a long time until somebody baptized me into sushiism. But I do enjoy it. But the way you test some things is you smell it. Does it smell good? We've been away 10 days, and this morning Linda opened the refrigerator and she smelled the milk. And she opened it up and went right over to the garbage disposal and got rid of it. You know, that was a pretty obvious smell test, wasn't it? So when David's saying, prove me, the Hebrew word that he used was, hey, God, give me the smell test. You know, do I smell stinky? Half rotten? Or do I pass this test? Try my reins, the third phrase, in this request to test. He says the word here rendered try or test is one that is most commonly applied to metals. Again, we get back to this. And the three words together express the earnest desire of the psalmist that God would examine into the evidences of his piety or his character. Those evidences to which he immediately refers and apply the proper kind of tests to determine whether their piety is genuine. The word rendered reins means properly the kidneys. And hence it is used to denote the inward parts of the body, the mind, the soul, the seat of the desires and the affections of humans. We speak of the heart as the seat of affections and love. And that's what David was asking God to examine or to test. So we recognize that this life, through the words of David and others, is like a testing ground for our character. As Barnes expresses it, piety. I think all of us here know that behavior change is the key to character building. If our behavior does not change over a period of time, as I will add here in a little bit with God's help, then we're falling short. And we might not pass the test. It's like buying a used car that hasn't been maintained very well. Won't pass the test. When I moved to Boston several years ago, traffic in Boston is known as the worst in the United States. It has a bad reputation. There's a lot of traffic circles there. A lot of people in Boston drive aggressively, more aggressive than Californians in many cases. And so as soon as we were there 3 or 4 weeks, my wife said, I want you to buy me a tank as a car. Something that's, you know, is going to intimidate other people and I'm not going to get hurt if I get hit. So I bought her a very old Mercedes-Benz, an old 450 SEL. It was about 20 years old. But I bought it from an attorney. And it looked beautiful, dark blue. It had that tan interior leather. It had a V8, and it would go very fast on the Mass Turnpike. And I thought, well, this is a nice big car. She didn't drive a lot of miles, but she wanted something that would protect her. And it had a good safety rating, and I thought, this will be good. And I took her to see the car. She liked it. And I told the attorney I was buying it from, I said, I'd like to take it to a mechanic just to have it looked at. So he put it up on the lift, and the mechanic went through it. And I said, well, what do you think? He says, well, the engine's strong, and the transmission looks good. He says, but it's been on the coast. There's a little town called Marblehead just on the north side of Boston. It's right on the coast. Beautiful little town on the cliffs of New England. And that's where this attorney had lived. He'd moved to Beacon Hill. And when I saw the car, he was living there. But he had lived in Marblehead. And there had been a little salty air get into the car. And he said, I would be careful about this car. But you know what I did? I didn't take that mechanic's warning. Because this car looks so beautiful. And my wife loved it, so we bought the car. It ran okay for about a year and a half, and then one day I got a call from my wife who'd gone shopping. And she was on the side of the road. The car had some distresses. And she said, come and get me. I said, why? She says, the car is falling apart. What do you mean? Does it still run? Yes, it runs, but it's not safe. So I got in my car, and I went, and I looked at this Mercedes that I had purchased. And it turned out that the metal parts of the car had fatigued, and Bondo had been put into the panel under the door and to the floor pan. It had been just kind of tacked together. And what had happened when she stopped at a stop sign is the rocker panel and part of the floor fell off of the car. And you could see the highway under the passenger side of the car. And she, of course, naturally was afraid to drive it, so she pulled it over to the side of the road. So the integrity of the car had just fallen apart. Deep down inside, it wasn't worth too much. Looked good on the outside, but I had to virtually junk the car. I ended up selling it for the price of the stereo. It had a really nice stereo in it. So I sold it to an acquaintance who bought it for the stereo. And ever since then, I've been more careful to listen to the mechanic when he tells me about a car. But behavior change, you know, the maintenance you put into the car, the stability, you know, is what really makes it last and be worthwhile. The same with human beings. You know, if we're maintaining through spiritual disciplines, the insides, things that really count that David asked to be tested, then, you know, we'll endure to the end. But if there are major character flaws, you know, if somebody's put a lot of Bondo, we may look good every Sabbath, but if we have spiritual Bondo, we're going to fall apart under stress, right? If I can be so crude as to use that analogy. George Barna, you know, the famous surveyor from Ventura, California, surveyed 85,000 Christian families. And he asked them about habits that they had and things they did. And he determined, after surveying 85,000 families, half of which claimed to be Christian, half of which claimed to be either agnostic or atheist. And at the end of the day, at the end of his book, he wrote a book entitled The Frog in the Kettle. Maybe some of you read it several years ago. His survey concluded there was no difference in the behavior of the two groups. The born-again Christians claim to be Christian. You know, they look really good on the outside. The agnostics and atheists didn't really care. But the remarkable thing is, he said their behavior was the same. Their language, as we heard about in the sermonette, was the same. Didn't matter. And that's where the rubber meets the road. The character, what's inside of each of us, has to do with our behavior and our change in behavior. Let's go to 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 2, 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15. 2 Timothy 2, verse 15. Paul writes this about what's inside of us that David asked to be tested. He said, "Be diligent to present yourselves approved to God, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth." Be diligent to present yourself approved to God. This is a very interesting word, approved. In the Greek, it is dokimos. Now, you probably don't know what a dokimos is, but in the ancient Roman world, a dokimos was a very important figure in each town of any size. Dokimos was the man who struck the coinage in a community. The Greek culture, the Roman culture, they didn't have, like we do, cities where you have treasuries and where you produce money. I don't know how many of you have been to Philadelphia, but if you go to Philadelphia, you can actually tour the factory that makes coins for distribution in the United States. There's one in Philadelphia and there's one in San Francisco. Down in San Francisco, there's one. They mint coins. They call it minting coins. And they're authorized by the federal government to mint coins. And, you know, you've got coins in your pocket, right? You've got like a quarter in your pocket. Maybe even you might even have a dollar coin in your pocket. And if you're really old, you might have a silver dollar in your pocket, right? And that was minted either in Philadelphia or San Francisco, that coin. And it'll have the initial right on the coin where it was minted. So in our culture today, we have mints. We have two major mints in our country. But in the ancient Greek and Roman world, they did not have mints. They had a dokimos in each major town. And he tested and minted the coinage. I just happen to have a Roman coin with me today for this special purpose. I'm going to show it to you, and I am actually going to dare to pass it around. I hope to get it back at the end of the service. But you'll see the coin has the emperor's face on one side, and on the back side, it has one of the Roman gods. This is the god of war in particular. And you'll see this coin around the edge. It's not straight and even like the coins that we have minted in our country. It doesn't even have grooves on the side. In fact, if you do have one of those old silver dollars, you notice it's got those little notches. Do you know why it's got those notches on the old silver dollar? To keep people from shaving the sides of it. Because if people could get a coin and they could shave the side just a very little bit and they would build a little pile of silver filings, they could actually melt that down and have a block of precious metal. So they put those little ridges on the edge of the coin to keep people from cheating. Okay? Now we have coins that are not pure silver or gold generally. I mean, they mint gold coins. But generally speaking, but they still have that little ridge on them. So you can't cheat. But you'll notice on these old Roman coins, this is a silver coin here, it's rough around the edges. Now, what the dokimos did, he took silver, he would smelt it down into the exact weight of the coin, because each of them had a denomination like we have today. And then he would put it on a mold, which was kind of like a little reverse cone, and the mold on the top of it was made out of wood. And he would pour the little piece of silver on top of that, and then he would take another piece and put it on top, and he would hit it with a hammer. Boom! A mallet. So you've got kind of a cone going, a reverse coin going this way, and a reverse coin cone going that way. And in the middle, you'd have the figure of either the emperor or the Roman god on one side of this press. They called them coin presses. And he would hit them with a mallet and then pull them off and let them cool. And then he would check the weight again to make sure it was okay. Now, what was interesting is in the marketplace, if you've got a coin that you thought somebody had shaved some of the silver off of, you could go to the dokimos and you could say, "Is this the right weight?" And he'd take it and he'd weigh it in his little scale and he'd go, "Yeah, it's the right weight." Now, if you got shorted and there was an unscrupulous person who was circulating the coin and he'd shave some off, collecting the silver, the dokimos would say, nope, you're shortchanging yourself. You ever heard that? Short weight. And you need to melt this down and add silver to it, and I'll make you, or I'll give you another coin that's the right weight. So that's basically what the dokimos did in every town. So when Paul says, verse 15, be diligent to present yourself approved to God, he says, you need to go through the dokimos test. Are you full value? Or have we kind of shaved away and carved away ourselves a little bit? That's what it meant. Now I'm going to pass this to the congregation. Again, this being a Christian church, I hope to get it back at the end of services today. But so take a look at the coin. You'll get an idea about what I'm talking about, the job of the dokimos. Now this example, this word dokimos in the Greek is used more than once. But Paul says, verse 15, be diligent to present yourself approved to God. That means full value. Like a coin, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, because you're not shortchanging yourself, you're not short of value, rightly dividing the word of truth. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21, where this word is used again. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 21. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21. You probably dedicated this verse to memory. Probably know it well. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21. Test all things. Now, in the King James, it says prove all things, right? Test all things. What does that mean? Well, this is the verb. It says dokimazo. That is the act that the dokimos went through was to test the metal, to test the gold, the silver, or the bronze. Those are the primary three metals, depending on the value of the coin that was used in the Greek and the Roman world. Test all things, hold fast what is good. So if it was a full value, it was the right test, it had gone through the dokimos process, through dokimazo, the act of taking it through that process, and it was good value, you'd keep it, right? Just like the coin that you see there that's full value. So the character that God seeks, putting it on the spiritual plane, is a full value qualities that his people would possess. So when Paul admonishes the Thessalonian church to test all things, he says, put it through the dokimazo test. Is it genuine? Does it have good value? Does it have full value? And hold fast what is good, what is full value. Not compromised in some way, but whatever is full value. Prove all things, hold fast to the good. Well, how do we do that? Well, look at verse 22. Abstain from every form of evil. Now, we just heard in a sermonette, small form of evil that people sometimes can engage in inadvertently. I have a 10-year-old, I think he's 10 years old, grandson. He was 9 last summer, and my son will occasionally go to the feast, but the woman that he married, Jessie, is a very nice, very fine woman. We're glad to have her as our daughter-in-law, but she doesn't know much about the church. She's learning, though, through my son, because he forbids any pork or shellfish in the house. And, of course, that's what she loves, is shellfish. So one of the first questions she asked us when she met us was, what's all this about shellfish? And, you know, she asked these questions. But we were talking with my son and my son and law, I mean my daughter-in-law, and our grandson came up, and I was talking about camp last year. And he said, camp, what's it like? And I explained what camp was like. And my son remembered going to camp all those years in the church. And he said, Aiden, you would like to go to camp. So anyway, to make a long story short, our son applied for and was accepted to our camp program. Which is, we do that even though kids may not attend church. If their grandparents attend church, we let them come to camp. So he got a ride with a bunch of the kids in the church and a family coming from Los Angeles, because he lives in San Diego. So my son brought him up and dropped him off, and this family brought him up in the van. And this last week, I was talking to some people in the L.A. church, and one of the guys said, "Oh, yeah, I remember your grandson." He said, "We took him in our van to camp last year." And I said, "Oh, how do you do?" He said, "Oh, he did well. 10 minutes, you know, he was kind of quiet at first, but within 10 minutes, he got to know everybody and was chatting it up with all the kids." He said, "But I must tell you that he had a bad habit that I began working on him right away." He said, "Every other phrase was OMG. You know, we heard about that in the sermonette. So here's our 9-year-old grandson. Of course, we're not around him very much because we lived away. But OMG, OMG this, OMG that. And so the driver of the car, a very nice man but a firm spirit, said, "We don't say that around here. We don't say that in our car, and we're not going to say that at camp. So you better undo that habit right now." And he said, my grandson slipped up 2 or 3 times, but in the car and for the next week at camp, he got rid of that. He didn't use it. You know, kids, when they're younger, they can shed habits pretty easily. But I just thought it was remarkable that I didn't know that until last week when I was talking to this guy who was driving him, that he had this little problem, if you will, taking God's name in vain, and didn't know what he was doing until he got to camp. And then he got a little instruction on exactly what he was doing. And then he went, "OMG." And we said, no. Once he realized what he was doing, we said, "Don't say that." Anyway, he was learning. So when it says here, abstain from every form of evil, even the little stuff. A few years ago, some young people had shown up in Boston when I was pastoring the church there. They were a young couple. They weren't married. They were good friends. They were dating, I think. They were describing this road trip they were taking across the United States. And it came out in the discussion that they had been sharing a hotel room to save money. And I said, "You both grew up in the church, both members of the church. Do you see anything wrong with that?" "Wrong with what?" And I said, "Sharing a hotel room." "Oh, we get double beds. We sleep in separate beds." I said, "Yeah, but what does that look like? I can respect the fact that you guys aren't sleeping together before you're married, but what does that look like?" And they go, "Well, we hadn't thought about that." And I said, "Well, not only should you abstain from evil, but the appearance of evil, as Paul says." I said, "It may cost you a little more money, but you should really be sleeping in separate rooms." Right? Oh, it came back. Thank you, John. It's not a whole lot of silver there. I gave you one of the... Well, never mind. Anyway. Let's read verse 23. "Now, may the God of peace himself set you apart completely. And may your whole spirit, soul, and body be preserved and blameless at the coming," or until the coming, "of our Lord Jesus Christ." Wasn't this what David was asking? Wasn't he saying, "May your whole spirit, soul, and body..." He was asking God to test everything about me. "I want you to know all about me." That's what Paul was admonishing these folks to do in language they understood, because every town had a dokimos. And these people interacted with the commerce in their town, in their city. Let's go to Luke chapter 16, verse 10. Luke 16, verse 10. Luke 16, verse 10, again, a scripture we're probably all familiar with, but I'd like us to think in terms of this in light of character building, or these things that David asked to be tested in him. Luke 16, 10, it says, "He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much." When it comes to character and what's inside of us, I think we all recognize that the process is we do the little things, and then when the big tests come, we're prepared for them. Let me share with you what Clark's commentary says about this verse. "He who has the genuine principles of fidelity within him will make a point of conscience of clearly attending to even the smallest things. And it is by habituating himself to act uprightly in little things that he acquires the gracious habit of acting with propriety, fidelity, honor, and conscience in matters of the greatest concern. On the contrary, he who does not act uprightly in small matters will seldom feel himself bound to pay much attention to the dictates of honor and conscience in cases of high importance. Can we reasonably expect that a man who is continually falling by little things has the power to resist temptations of great proportion?" Wasn't too long ago that a friend of mine went to Trader Joe's and he bought a bunch of groceries, and among the groceries that he bought was a leg of lamb. And he took his bags and he went home, and when he was unloading his groceries on the counter and looked at the receipt, he happened to notice that they had not charged him for the leg of lamb somehow. It missed the scanner when he went through. Well, he put the receipt and the leg of lamb back in his bag, and he took it back to Trader Joe's. And he took it to the manager, and he said, "I bought this earlier in the day, or I thought I bought it earlier in the day, but it did not go through the register, so I wasn't charged for it." And the manager looked at him, and he said, "Are you crazy?" He says, "Nobody has ever brought anything back to me to pay for it." But my friend has a very disciplined conscience. What is really interesting is now the manager and all of the people who work in that Trader Joe's know my friend. They hardly recognize the other customers, but they know my friend because they know he's honest. He has a high level of integrity, a high level of honesty. It was a little thing. A lot of us might just say, "Oh, well, they have a certain loss factor in their store anyway. They'll never notice." It was a little thing. But it's the indication of a larger thing, isn't it? Character. When I was working in Ohio, we had a strict rule among the students there that they shouldn't drink alcohol under the age of 21. Even if they were in the private home. That was the rule we had. And one of the members there in the church came to me and he said, "I just want you to know something." He says, "The students here are of the highest integrity." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Because they came to my home and we were going to go eat. We were eating dinner on a Friday night. We'd invited them to eat dinner. And we offered them wine at our home. And they all said, 'No, thank you.'" He said, "Well," I said, "it's okay. It's in my home." And they said, "Sorry. We're under 18, and it is against the law in most states, even though the host gives you permission. It is unlawful and against the law for anyone under 21 to drink alcohol, even in a private home." And he said, "These students said, 'No, thank you. We don't want to drink.'" He said, I thought you should know that about some of these students." I was proud of those students. They showed integrity in a very small thing. I mean, it could have slipped through. They could have had a small glass of wine, not affected anybody. But they knew better, and they knew it was against the rules. They knew it was against the law. And they upheld a very small thing. Again, I don't know how many of you have taken that class, Growing Kids God's Way, but there's a section in there on, you know, teaching your children to do things right, even the little things. And the facilitator, Gary Ezzo, on those tapes, encourages all the parents. In fact, that's one of the pieces of homework is during the week, the parent has to, in front of the child, take the cart, the shopping cart, back to the corral. Remember that, Leslie, in that class?
I still do it every time.
Confession is good for the soul. That's good, Leslie. but, you know, sometimes you finish, you know, your shopping and you unload your groceries or whatever into the car and you push the cart. And they did show this little video of this cart going unmanned across the parking lot, crashing into the side of another car, you know, and creating, you know, a little dent in the door, which would be expensive to have removed. They showed that little video, but it's one of those little things that gets ingrained in your head. And Leslie's right. Ever since I've seen that in the videos, I become conscious of it. And even though we don't have kids to show that example to, Linda and I are always conscientious, nearly always. We may slip up once in a while, but she's always conscious of taking the cart back to the cart corral and not just leaving it in the middle of the parking lot. It's a little thing. But what does the scripture say? Luke 16, verse 10. And you can think of 100 other little things, I'm sure. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. It is true, isn't it? Character is built in the small things, the little things, the shaving of the coin, you know, the little compromises when no one's looking. That's what David asked God to test. He said, test me in that. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. Romans 8. In Romans 8 and verse 5 is where I'd like to begin. Romans 8 verse 5. I think the missing element in most of those people in Barna's study is found here. An element that you and I have access to. Romans 8 and verse 5. For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So then those who are in the flesh cannot please God. Therefore, God offers us His Holy Spirit. It is God's Spirit that helps us change our behavior, to become pure at heart, as David asks for God's test to prove. Verse 9, but you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. David said that. He said, don't take your spirit from me. By the help and the power of your spirit, I want you to help me be character filled. I want you to be able to test what's inside of me and examine, is it good? Is it right? Is it full value? Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his. Verse 9, but you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. God's Spirit is what helps us change our behavior. It is the missing element for real overcoming and character building in this world. And that's what God asked, or what David asked God to test within him, and what we should have the courage to ask for. God, test us. try our reins. See what's inside. Let's go over to chapter 12. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy. That means acting right. It means filled with God's Spirit. It means not compromising, even in the littlest things. Focusing on character building. Holy, acceptable to God. Which is your reasonable or logical service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. The word for renewing of our mind is dokimazo. It's that process of testing our metal, if you will. What are we really made out of? Do not be conformed to this world and its standards, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove, that's that word, dokimazo, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And we prove that by building character, by overcoming, by growing. By displaying our character even in the smallest matters. Let's remember to be diligent and faithful in the little things, unwilling to compromise and whittle away our character. We must practice character building acts and teach it to our children and our grandchildren. It is only through building character that we will truly change our behavior and please God. This is what David wanted. He wanted God to kick the tires. He wanted God to take a close look. He wanted God to examine what's deep down inside. Because after all, isn't that really what counts? Is what we're really made out of? The metal we're made out of? It's what's inside the heart, the soul, and the mind that really counts to God.